You know, when we watch the evening news, and we see a country just suddenly descend into chaos, it usually looks like an earthquake. Like one day everything seems fine, or well, at least functioning.
Yeah, functioning enough, usually.
Right. And then literally the next day, borders are closed, the currency is totally worthless, and the government has just, completely collapsed.
It's terrifying to watch.
It is. It feels incredibly sudden. I mean, entirely unpredictable, kind of like a lightning strike. But what if we've been looking at global instability completely
Right.
backwards?
What if it's not a lightning strike at all?
Exactly. What if a country collapsing isn't a sudden explosion, but more like a building infested with termites? The collapse only looks sudden from the outside.
Oh, I like that analogy. The rot is hidden.
Yeah, the rot has been spreading through the foundation for years, leaving this very clear, highly mechanical blueprint of failure behind it.
The dangerous blind spot we have,
Yeah.
honestly. We are practically trained by the whole, 24-hour news cycle to focus on that spectacular moment of collapse.
The loud crash.
Right, the loud crash, rather than the quiet systemic decay that made the building so fragile in the first place. I mean, when you only watch for earthquakes, you completely ignore the termites.
Which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. Welcome in, everyone. Our mission today is to fundamentally change how you view global instability. We're throwing out the idea that countries collapse overnight in these unpredictable revolutions.
They really don't.
They don't. So instead, we're going to look at the hidden mechanical blueprint of state failure. And to do this, we are unpacking this truly fascinating presentation from May 2026.
A brilliant piece of work.
It really is. It's titled Governance Strategy and Policy Challenges by Michel Henry Boucher. And his background is actually what makes this so compelling, I
Oh,
think.
absolutely.
He's a former senior economist at the World Bank and an emeritus professor at Schema Business School.
And his perspective is incredibly valuable because, it's not just purely theoretical, it's not just academic musings, and it's not just cold Wall Street data either.
Right.
Boucher blends high-level global finance with this intense academic rigor. He understands how the money moves, but he also really understands how institutions decay.
Okay, let's unpack this because the data he presents, it proves that countries don't just snap, they leave a trail of breadcrumbs.
Very visible ones, if you know where to look.
Exactly. There are highly accurate early warning signs, and we're going to uncover exactly what those are for you. But I guess to understand the collapse, we have to understand the starting point.
The baseline, yeah.
Right. Before a state officially hits that terrifying label of failed, it usually spends years or even decades just being categorized as a weak state.
That is the initial step on the downward staircase. But we have to be careful about how we define weakness here. In the context of a nation state, I mean.
Because people usually think of military size, right?
Yeah, a lot of people assume a weak state just means a country with a small military or, maybe a really low GDP.
But I would guess it has more to do with the social contract, doesn't it? Like, think of it like a human immune system.
Okay, yeah, go with that.
If a functioning state is supposed to provide a baseline of protection for its citizens, what Boucher actually calls common goods,
Right, common goods.
things like health, education, food security, clean water, basic infrastructure, then a weak state is simply one that fails to deliver those things. It's either unable or completely unwilling to uphold its end of the bargain.
That's the absolute core of it. When the state fails to provide those common goods, the social contract just breaks.
And people feel it immediately.
They do. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Boucher outlines this process in what he calls the unfolding of state failure. It's this incredibly predictable cascade.
How does it start?
It begins with weak institutions. When the courts, the regulatory bodies, the public services lose their integrity, that's when corruption and opacity seep in.
So going back to the metaphor from earlier, the weak institutions are the damp wood and the corruption is the termites moving in.
And once those termites are in, they work fast.
Right.
I mean, really fast. That underlying corruption inevitably leads to loose regulations.
Because the people making the rules are the ones benefiting from breaking them.
Exactly. Loose regulations exist for one reason, which is to allow the concentration of political and economic power into the hands of a very small elite.
Right.
And that rapidly accelerates the wealth gap. The public sees deficient infrastructure, plunging foreign investment, rising food insecurity, all while select few just get vastly richer.
It's a recipe for disaster.
It is. Eventually, society reaches a boiling point. The decay devolves into coups d'etats, civil wars, and repressive regimes. And finally, it crosses the threshold into a failed state or a rogue state.
Triggering massive migration flows and regional turmoil, yeah. But let me play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure.
When we look at recent history, don't a lot of these states fail because of some massive external shock, like a sudden global pandemic or a global market crash that just dries up all their funding?
That's what it looks like on the surface, yeah.
Right. And it seems like those external factors are what actually pull the rug out from under them.
It's a very common assumption, but it mistakes the catalyst for the cause. External shocks absolutely precipitate state failure, but they're literally just the wind blowing down a house that was already hollowed out.
The termites already did the real damage.
Exactly. The rot was already there. A healthy state absorbs a shock. A weak state shatters. And this leads to a very, very urgent warning Boucher delivered in his 2026 seminar.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, he literally titled one of his sections, "This Time It's Different."
Wow. "This time it's different" is probably the most terrifying phrase an economist can use.
Really is.
What makes right now so uniquely dangerous?
Well, we are currently seeing converging economic, trade, and geopolitical shockwaves, all simultaneously battering countries that are already internally fragile.
A perfect storm.
Boucher points to this brutal combination. Large national debt, meager economic growth, high real interest rates, shrinking external financing, and this is huge higher energy and food import prices.
Okay, let's break that math down for the listener because that combination is lethal.
It's mathematically impossible to survive for long.
Right. If a weak state is running on debt just to, you know, keep the lights on, and global interest rates spike, suddenly a massive chunk of their national budget is going purely to paying interest.
Yep.
That leaves nothing for those common goods we talked about. No money for food subsidies, no money for health care.
Nothing at all.
So you apply that immense external pressure to a state with corrupt, weak institutions, and failure isn't just a possibility anymore. It becomes mathematically predictable.
They simply cannot withstand the math. The pressure breaks whatever is left of the state's functional capacity.
So if weak institutions and corruption are the foundation rotting away, what is the actual concrete we should be pouring? Like, what stops the decay?
Well, the research pivots here to explore this concept of good governance.
And I have to say, the way Boucher introduces this is just brilliant. He doesn't start with a spreadsheet. He actually starts with a painting.
Oh, the Siena fresco. Yes.
Yeah.
It's such a striking visual for an economic presentation.
It really is. He uses this 14th century fresco from Siena, Italy, called the Allegory of Good Government. It depicts this beautiful, harmonious balance of wisdom, justice, strength, and peace.
It's gorgeous.
But what's amazing is that a 700-year-old piece of art perfectly illustrates the exact same metrics the World Bank uses today to measure governance.
The World Bank just uses slightly less poetic, more bureaucratic terms.
Yeah, exactly.
They measure it through accountability, political stability, government effectiveness, regulatory quality, the rule of law, and the control of corruption.
But the underlying philosophy is identical to the Siena painting.
Completely. It's the modern, measurable version of wisdom and justice.
But, you know, this brings up a massive contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something you might be wondering about right now as you listen to this.
What's that?
Looking at the data on fragile states, many of them possess massive natural resources. Some are sitting on absolute oceans of oil or vast mineral deposits. If you have infinite money buried under your feet, shouldn't you be able to just buy your way out of failure? I mean, how can a state be collapsing if it is, on paper, incredibly rich?
It is one of the great tragedies of global economics, really.
Mm-hmm.
And Boucher captures it perfectly with a very stark quote. He says, "Fragile states are rich countries with poor people."
Rich countries with poor people. Wow.
Yeah. It comes down to what economists call the trilemma of growth and development.
Okay, let me guess how this works. We naturally assume that if a country's GDP is growing, society is getting better.
That's the assumption, yeah.
But if you have dynamic economic growth and you pair it with bad governance and a corrupt regime, does a growing GDP just mean there's a much bigger pile of cash for warlords or politicians to steal?
That is exactly the mechanism. Without good governance, economic growth actually leads directly to violence.
Wait, violence?
Yeah, because the stakes of controlling the government become so much higher, there's more to steal. And the data takes that a step further, showing this is especially toxic with commodity-driven growth like oil or diamonds.
Why is commodity wealth so much worse than, say, a booming manufacturing sector?
Well, think about what it takes to build a thriving manufacturing or tech sector.
You need an educated workforce.
Exactly. You need millions of healthy, educated citizens. You need reliable public transportation, stable electricity, good schools. You are forced to invest in your population to generate wealth.
Ah, I see. But to extract oil.
You don't need a highly educated, widespread middle class. You just need heavy machinery, foreign capital, and a tall fence around the oil field. The citizens are largely irrelevant to the profit generation.
That makes total sense. So oil wealth naturally concentrates power into the hands of whoever controls the land, which just breeds massive corruption. There's literally no incentive to build schools if your wealth comes from a pipeline.
Precisely why good governance is the only antidote. It is the mechanism that forces raw economic growth to be transformed into inclusive, sustainable development.
Otherwise, the money just disappears to the top.
Right. Without transparency, accountability, and the rule of law, natural resources are almost always a curse, not a cure.
It's so easy to call corruption a moral failing, something we can just shake our heads at on the news. But the hard data in Boucher's research shows it's actually a mathematical death sentence.
The numbers are grim.
He lists the six key ingredients of state fragility. So that's weakness of institutions, bad governance, income gaps, commodity dependence, limited socioeconomic freedom, and a decline in democratization. And when you look at the numbers, the human cost is just staggering.
What's fascinating here is that the correlation is totally undeniable. High corruption is mathematically tied to low human development.
Yeah, if you graph this out, like if you put a country's corruption score on one side and how long its citizens are expected to live on the other, you don't get a random scattering of dots.
No, not at all.
You get a direct, devastating line. The worse the corruption, the younger the people die. Places like the Central African Republic, Chad, Somalia.
It's tragic.
Their extreme corruption scores align perfectly with life expectancies trapped in the 50s.
It makes the abstract concept of institutional decay horrifyingly real. It shows us how corruption actually functions on the ground.
Like stealing from a hospital fund.
Exactly. When funds meant for a water treatment plant are siphoned off to buy a luxury villa in Europe, people literally die of cholera. The money meant for the common goods vanishes, and the cost is measured in decades of human life lost.
And, you know, we shouldn't trick ourselves into thinking this is only a problem for the poorest nations either. The data shows corruption is a global sliding scale.
Oh, definitely.
Boucher highlights the scores of the major BRICS nations and other massive global economies. Places like Russia, which scores 157th on the Transparency International map, or Iran at 153rd.
It proves that having a massive military or a huge geopolitical footprint does not equate to good governance.
And the citizens ultimately pay the price for that opacity.
Always. Which brings us to the most practical application of this entire framework, I think. If the descent into failure is gradual and the data is this clear, how can we spot a state on the verge of total collapse before the tanks roll into the streets?
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this is the part of the research that is incredibly actionable. The ultimate alarm bells are actually completely silent.
Yes, they don't make a sound.
If corruption is the termites eating the foundation, the ultimate early warning sign is the rats fleeing the ship. We are talking about brain drain and capital flight.
The smart people and the big money.
Exactly. The wealthy elites feel the floorboards rotting first, so they move their money and their families out before the roof caves in.
Capital flight is the ultimate vote of no confidence. It is the purest, most measurable symptom of institutional weakness. People and businesses realize that the domestic banking system is no longer safe.
Or that their property rights are no longer secure.
Right, or that the local currency is about to implode.
Yeah.
But the most cynical part of Boucher's data is how this mechanism functions in fragile states that are actively receiving international aid.
Oh, this is the part of the data that honestly made me so angry.
Understandably so.
Yeah.
A massive portion of the external financing given to these fragile states, and we were talking about international development loans from global organizations, money explicitly meant to build infrastructure or stabilize the local economy.
Yeah.
It actually gets recycled right back out of the country into external offshore private bank deposits.
Wait, let's break that math down in plain English. The presentation points to a statistic regarding African countries at the end of 2025. It looked at the ratio of offshore deposits to domestic credit claims. And for households, it was at 400%.
It's unbelievable.
What does that actually mean for the money, like mechanically?
Well, a domestic credit claim is essentially the money banks lend out locally to build businesses and fuel the domestic economy. If offshore deposits are at 400% of that, it means that for every single dollar actively being used to build the local economy, $4 are sitting hidden in private, offshore, international bank accounts.
So the international community is pumping money in the front door to help, and the corrupt elite are quietly vistling it out the back door to Switzerland or the Cayman Islands.
That is the grim reality. The money flowing out to international banks far exceeds what is staying in the local economy.
And we can actually see this happen in real time, right? The data tracks this behavior year by year.
We can. The presentation includes a fascinating historical chart tracking private non-bank deposits from Tunisia held in international banks. It spans from 1977 all the way through 2025.
Wow. And I'm guessing it's not a smooth, steady line.
Not at all. It looks like an electrocardiogram of political panic. You see violent, sudden spikes in money fleeing the country, and those spikes map perfectly onto moments of domestic political instability.
So as soon as there's a protest.
As soon as a regime cracks down, or there is an uprising, the domestic capital immediately flees to safety offshore.
And just to prove that this isn't some phenomenon restricted to emerging markets, the data shows this is a universal principle of behavioral economics.
Oh, absolutely. Capital is a coward no matter where it lives.
I love that phrasing. Capital is a coward.
Yeah. Boucher includes a chart showing U.S. households expatriating their savings, actually.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. It tracks bank deposits placed outside the United States between 2013 and 2025. And you can trace the rising and falling flows of that capital flight directly to periods of intense domestic political uncertainty in the U.S.
That's wild.
The behavior is identical everywhere. Capital always flees from uncertainty and poor governance.
And Boucher actually gives us a formula for this, doesn't he? It's not just a theory. It's a literal equation.
He does. Based on the data, a 1% increase in the quality of governance actually reduces the flow of expatriated savings by 1.45%.
So improving transparency and the rule of law, literally, mathematically, keeps money inside the country where it can be used for actual development.
Exactly.
The worse the governance, the larger the offshore bank accounts. It is the most reliable, leading indicator of a state in deep trouble.
If you track the capital flight, you can predict the collapse.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the mechanics of oil wealth to the behavioral economics of fleeing capital. So what does this all mean for you listening right now?
It's a lot to process.
It is. But the biggest takeaway is a complete paradigm shift in how you process global news. State failure is not an earthquake. It is a gradual, highly measurable disease of institutional decay.
It's in the termites.
It's the termites. It starts with weak institutions failing to provide basic goods. It is fueled by corruption and the concentration of wealth, and it is signaled loudly and clearly by money and talent fleeing the country.
And this framework is incredibly practical for your daily life. Whether you are analyzing global supply chains for your business, evaluating international investments, or honestly, just trying to make sense of the chaotic headlines, you now have the exact framework that World Bank economists use.
It's empowering.
You can look past the surface level GDP growth, look past the commodity wealth, and ask the right questions. Are they providing common goods? Is there a massive wealth gap? And most importantly, is the domestic capital quietly fleeing for the exits?
It genuinely gives you X-ray vision for global politics.
Yeah.
But as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, slightly uncomfortable thought to mull over.
Oh boy.
Yeah. We've spent this entire time dissecting the mechanics of corrupt, failing states and how their ultimate early warning system is capital flight, the wealthy elite moving their stolen money to safety in offshore bank deposits. But if fleeing capital is the ultimate proof of a corrupt, failing state, what does it say about the broader global financial ecosystem? Because those offshore haven accounts, the very vaults holding that stolen development aid, are almost always hosted, regulated, and protected by the world's wealthiest and most supposedly well-governed nations.
It forces you to ask who is really benefiting from the decay.
Exactly. And who is complicit in the system of state failure we've been analyzing? Something to think about the next time you see a headline about a sudden revolution.
The money left a long time ago.
The money usually left town years before the tanks arrived. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Catch you next time.